So you're listening to Speaking of Animals. I'm Lori Sonnenfeld, and glad to be here, and I'm excited to be talking with Nathan Winograd, who is the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution. And first, Nathan, I need to say that the empowering and exciting message of your book is one that is going to resonate so deeply with my listeners and so many other people who felt the weight of all this killing for so long and felt powerless to do anything about it in the face of the experts' analysis of the pet overpopulation problem. So I'm excited to hear about your book. Why is the book called Redemption?
Well, redemption has multiple meanings in the animal sheltering world. When someone loses their pet, they go to the shelter, and the shelter and the animals there, and they reclaim the animal. That's called a redemption. But redemption also has a larger meaning, which is not only to atone for past mistakes, but to also come back to the roots of our high ideals. And the central message of the book is that the humane movement in the United States was started with the highest ideals of compassion, and we created these vehicles, these which are humane societies and societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals, to save animals and to increase their status in society. And somewhere along the way, and somewhere through history, we lost our way, and the vehicles that were created to save lives have unfortunately become the leading killers of dogs and cats. The no-kill movement is trying to get us back to those high ideals, and for all of us, and for the humane societies out there that are embracing the no-kill philosophy, and for our ideals as stewards of homeless animals, when we achieve a no-kill nation, it will truly be redemption for all of us.
That's true. So tell me, what is your background that makes you an expert in this area?
Well, for one, I came into this movement as an attorney, and so I came in definitely not as an expert, and I think that was actually my saving grace, because I didn't come into this movement with the idea that this is the way we've always done it, or there were, and I didn't know the dogmas and the mantras and the status quo, and so I didn't follow it. And in looking at the problem of shelter killing and bringing an attorney's perspective of I want to get to a conclusion, and how do I get there, and through trial and error, I've managed to end up having worked at two of the most successful SPCAs in the country, one of them an animal control shelter, and was able to create the nation's first no-kill community. And since that time, I've worked with municipalities all over the country, and the end result of that has been communities that relied on killing and that operated as if there was no alternative to killing, have seen death rate declines in their community shelters from 50% to 75% in 1 to 2 years. And now we have no-kill communities in half a dozen counties in the United States, and my expectation is that will grow exponentially as more and more shelters and communities embrace the philosophy and the programs and services that make no-kill possible.
And what was the first no-kill community?
Well, San Francisco was the first city to end the killing of healthy homeless dogs and cats, and it was that model that I took to an animal control shelter in upstate New York, Tompkins County, New York, about 4 or 5 hours outside of New York City, and really brought all the programs and services that made San Francisco so successful to an animal control facility in upstate New York, and we ended up finishing saving 93% of all dogs and cats that entered our open-door animal control shelter, so really returning euthanasia to its dictionary definition, which is should only be applied to hopelessly ill or injured pets.
So was this 93% of the healthy animals or of all the animals?
Of all animals. And, you know, as an animal control shelter, we were mandated by law to take in all dogs and cats within our county. Mm. And as anyone who's ever worked or been around an animal shelter knows, that doesn't just mean the cute and cuddlies, but what I truly affectionately call the old and uglies, and vicious animals and all animals. And what we found was that really less than 10%, only about 7% of all dogs and cats entering our shelter were either hopelessly ill or injured, or in the case of dogs, truly vicious with a poor prognosis for rehabilitation. So even though we were an open-door shelter, we did life-saving surgery, we amputated limbs when necessary, we did care even if it took months of rehabilitation. And what I found since going to other communities like Charlottesville, Virginia, and Reno, Nevada, and other places, is that that figure pretty much holds across the board. For example, last year, Charlottesville, Virginia, went from a community that was killing over half of all dogs and cats entering its animal control shelter to saving 92%. In about a year. So
well, before we look at how that happens, how did it happen that we have the system in place that we do now?
Well, I mean, it's really a story that requires us to go back into history. Initially, in the 19th century, right after the Civil War, you start to see a massive urbanization in the United States, and consequently, an offshoot of that was what merchants and others felt was a stray dog problem. And every year, the cities would appoint a poundmaster to round up and kill stray dogs. The methods of killing at the time were very, very cruel. Some of them were shot, some of them were drowned. Some of them, like in Philadelphia, were literally beaten to death in the public squares. And SPCAs that were formed to protect and save lives decided that they were going to take over the pound contracts for their municipalities in order to reduce not only the public displays of killing, but the cruel methods used to kill. Mm. And what happened was their traditional platforms fell away as they were literally overwhelmed with taking in these dogs and later cats for their municipalities. And what was started as a movement of hope turned to despair that there was no other alternatives. The problem is, as we've become a more pet-loving society, as people have moved from the countryside to the cities and then to suburbia, as pets have gone from what I call the changing bees, from the barns to the backyard, literally to our bedrooms, and this humane ethic increased in the United States, and we've learned how to not halt pet reproduction through spaying and neutering, and these shelters have become very, very wealthy through people's philanthropy and generosity. We also created the tools to end population control killing, but people and shelters were so mired in this notion that there was no other way, that the answer in front of them, they were just simply blind to it, and that answer was to believe in the community and trust in the power of people's compassion. But because these shelters saw the public as the source of the problem, rather than embrace the public, they created these antagonistic relationships.
Hmm. Well, but why do you say that overpopulation is a myth?
Well, when you actually look at the numbers, well, two reasons. One, if you look at the numbers, every year in the data is pretty consistent, and every year in the United States, there's about twice as many new homes opening up for dogs than there are dogs entering the shelter. So sort of put another way, every year twice as many people are looking to bring a dog into their home than the number of dogs entering shelters, and more people are looking to bring a cat into their homes than the number of cats entering shelter.
Why is that increasing?
Well, one, it's the petless household that sort of has become the anomaly in the United States, and a lot has to do with this shift from urban to suburban that's going on all over the United States, and the creation of open space and parks and an increasing standard of living in the United States. So pets are more and more becoming family members and being integrated into our daily lives. Not all animals entering shelters actually need adoption. So the number of animals entering shelters that need adoption is actually not the total number, because a fair percentage of them are going to be reclaimed by their owners. Some of them are going to go to rescue group. Some of them, for example, are feral cats that don't need homes. These are wild, unsocialized cats. They need surgery and release. And some of them are unfortunately going to be hopelessly ill or injured, and that is truly where mercy euthanasia comes in. But the real reason, the more powerful explanation for why I argue that pet overpopulation is a myth is basically what has happened in about five or six communities that I talk about in the book, when their long-standing shelter directors were replaced by new ones who took killing off the table and decided that they were going to do anything and everything short of killing these homeless animals. And these communities, like Tompkins, like Reno, Nevada, like Charlottesville, Virginia, have literally become no-kill virtually overnight, reducing their death rates by 50 to 75% in less than 1 year, proving that there are enough loving homes for all the savable dogs and cats entering their facilities.
Oh, wow. So what kind of response do you get from established shelter workers and leaders?
Well, let me first say that the response by animal lovers and by, you know, Joe and Jane, dog and cat lover out in the community, and by the rescue groups who are in the trenches has been overwhelmingly positive. Interestingly enough, you know, the book is getting great reviews by those who have read it. Those that have not, you know, I've gotten a few really negative comments, and some of them have been, you know, realistically downright nasty. But without a doubt, these are people who have not read the book. And so I am getting negative feedback from a group that I call the Entrenched Shelter Establishment, and my response to all of them is read the book, because the most important responses I've gotten, the ones that have been most valuable to me, are from those who admitted that when they picked up the book, they started out incredibly skeptical or admittedly downright hostile, and they felt transformed at the end, because I believe, based on their comments and the reviews that we're getting, that the evidence is fairly unassailable, and that if people just pick up the book and read it, I believe the emotions they'll experience is ultimately they'll start out very, very upset and sad and angry, but at the end they'll walk away with not just a feeling of hope, but what I hope the title captures is redemption, and that together we'll move towards creating a no-kill nation.
Wow. So I want to tell people who just tuned in that we're talking with Nathan Winograd. And his book is called Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution. It's a mouthful, but it's a good title. It really speaks to what you're saying. So has it been hard to get your message out in the community? How is that going? And I definitely want to encourage you to speak to how do these transformations happen, and what can our listeners do to help make that happen, both of those things?
Well, there's two answers to your question. The first is it has not been hard to reach people who are open to the message. And I truly believe that as Americans, we are tired of the killing in shelters. Unfortunately, a fair share of us have been spoon-fed the notion that the best we can do for dogs and cats is to adopt some and kill the rest. And the whole purpose of the book was to put the information in people's hands to show why that, in fact, is not true, and that if we wanted to, we could be a no-kill nation today. That doesn't mean we don't have our work cut out for us, but at the end of the day, there are 150 million of us who have a loving relationship with a dog or cat and consider them part of our families. And on the other side, there are about 5,000 entrenched shelter directors who are thwarting our will that the killing come to an end. And so when you look at the numbers and the hearts and minds of the citizenry are truly on our side. And part of the way we're sharing that message is I am going coast to coast to about 17 different cities nationwide, including Portland, not only to do a book signing, but to do a free 90-minute seminar on how you build a no-kill community and what role, big or small, that your average animal lovers can play in that. And that's the message we're trying to bring, that really it takes a community, and the community starts with all of us.
Okay. And of course, people can pick up the book to learn how as well, correct?
Absolutely. And the book is available, you know, at all the online retailers and, of course, all the brick-and-mortar bookstores, including Powell's, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and people's favorite and local independent bookseller. But I do hope that people choose to come out to our presentation because there is no cost and it is open to the public.
I was just going to tell people when and where that is. It's November 4th, and I'm sure I wrote it down here. Yeah, there it is. November 4th at 6 p.m. at Lewis and Clark Law School, Room 7, and that's at 10015 Southwest Terwilliger and in Portland. And they can also go to your website, correct, to register for that?
Correct. It's www.nathanwinograd.com. And it lists all the cities we're visiting and how you RSVP.
How do you spell Winograd?
It's NathanWinograd. So it's spelled Winograd.
Okay, and then you can click there to register for the seminar.
And what's been really exciting is that the number of people who have been coming out to hear the message. And I just completed the East Coast portion of the book tour, and the response has just been incredibly overwhelming. And to me, that is further proof that we're tired of the killing, and we're looking for life-saving alternatives, because life-saving really reflects the values that we hold regarding dogs and cats.
And are you able to do any networking, creating networks of the people who are coming to the seminar?
I really leave that to people there and encourage people to talk to one another. And so part of the seminar is we spend about a half an hour before I actually start the presentation and allow people to meet and socialize with one another. And we also have an online community through the No Kill Advocacy Center, which is the national nonprofit I'm the director of, that allows people not only to get a free once-a-month e-newsletter that shows what different people in different communities are doing and to share our successes and our challenges, but allows people to participate in that dialogue as well.
So in one or two of the cities or counties that you're talking about that have recently made this change in the last year or so, what was it? What was the catalyst?
Well, there's a series of programs and services that are not nearly common enough in shelters. And unfortunately, as people will read in the book, shelters actively oppose implementing those programs. But really, without them, killing will continue indefinitely. And there are programs and services that I collectively call the no-kill equation, and they include really basic things like allowing the community to come into the shelter and help socialize the dogs and socialize the cats so that they remain happy and healthy through a volunteer program. It's programs to send animals who are not yet ready for adoption into private foster homes until they are. It's working with the rescue groups that are a legion in virtually every community. It's providing affordable spay-neuter since the cost is really prohibitive for a fair section of every community, on and on and on. But really, the primary factor which will determine whether a community is successful or not successful is who runs the animal control shelter and or large private shelter in the community. Because the central lesson from the successes of places like San Francisco and Tompkins County, New York, and Reno, Nevada, and Charlottesville, Virginia, and Ivan City, Utah, and increasingly in other places, is that the transformation didn't take 5 years. It didn't take 10 years. It literally happened within 1 or 2 years when their long-standing, traditional-focused shelter director was either retired, resigned, or pushed aside, and a new person, in fact, not only new to the shelter, but new to the field of sheltering, took over those shelters and came in perhaps not with the knowledge of what's a cleaning protocol and what's a sanitation protocol, but really with a passion for saving lives. And interestingly enough, in all these shelters, all the people that took over these large shelters were newcomers to animal control, and with one or two exceptions, interestingly enough, they've all been women.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a dramatic success. And I hope that it can continue around the country, and I think that what you're doing is certainly going to help make that happen. I want to repeat that on November 4th at 6 p.m., there will be a book signing and free 90-minute seminar on this topic. at Lewis and Clark Law School. And you can get more information on that by going to www.NathanWinograd.com. And where do they click for that once they're in there?
Once they're in there on the homepage, it'll say Building a No-Kill Community Nationwide Tour. Click here, and that'll take you to all the list of cities.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.